Go. 2 Kings chapter 6 and 7. Now the company of prophets said to Elisha, "As you see, the place where we live under your charge is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan, and let us collect logs there, one for each of us, and build a place there for us to live." He answered, "Do so." Then one of them said, "Please come with your servants." And he answered, "I will." So he went with them. When they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees, but as one was felling a log, his axe head fell into the water. He cried out, "Alas, master, it was borrowed." Then the man of God said, "Where did it fall?" When he showed him the place, he cut off a stick and threw it in there and made the iron float. He said, "Pick it up." So he reached out his hand and took it. Once when the king of Aram was at war with Israel, he took counsel with his officers. He said, "At such and such a place shall be my camp." But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, "Take care not to pass this place, because the Arameans are going down there." The king of Israel sent word to the place of which the man of God spoke. More than once or twice he warned such a place so that it was on alert. The mind of the king of Aram was greatly perturbed because of this. He called his officers and said to them, "Now tell me who among us sides with the king of Israel." Then one of his officers said, "No one, my lord king. It is Elisha, the prophet in Israel, who tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedchamber." He said, "Go and find where he is. I will send and seize him." He was told, "He is in Dothan." So he sent horses and chariots there and a great army. They came by night and surrounded the city. When an attendant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. His servant said, "Alas, master, what shall we do?" He replied, "Do not be afraid, for there are more with us than there are with them." Then Elisha prayed, "O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the servant, and he saw. The mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. When the Arameans came down against him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, "Strike this people, please, with blindness." So he struck them with blindness as Elisha had asked. Elisha said to them, "This is not the way, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek." And he led them to Samaria. As soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, "O Lord, open the eyes of these men so that they may see." The Lord opened their eyes, and they saw that they were inside Samaria. When the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, "Father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them?" He answered, "No. Did you capture with your sword and your bow those whom you want to kill? Set food and water before them so that they may eat and drink, and let them go to their master." So he prepared for them a great feast. After they ate and drank, he sent them on their way, and they went to their master. And the Arameans no longer came raiding into the land of Israel. Sometime later, King Ben-Hadad of Aram mustered his entire army. He marched against Samaria and laid siege to it. As the siege continued, famine in Samaria became so great that a donkey's head was sold for 80 shekels of silver and one-fourth of a cob of dove's dung for 5 shekels of silver. Now as the king of Israel was walking on the city wall, a woman cried out to him, "Help, my lord king." He said, "No, let the Lord help you. How can I help you? From the threshing floor or from the wine press?" But then the king asked her, "What is your complaint?" She answered, "This woman said to me, 'Give up your son, and we will eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow.' So we cooked my son and ate him. The next day I said to her, 'Give up your son, and we will eat him.' But she has hidden her son." When the king heard the words of the woman, he tore his clothes. Now since he was walking on the city wall, the people could see that he had sackcloth on his body underneath. And he said, "So may God do to me and more if the head of Elisha, son of Shaphat, stays on his shoulders today." So he dispatched a man from his presence. Now Elisha was sitting in his house, and the elders were sitting with him. Before the messenger arrived, Elisha said to the elders, "Are you aware that this murderer has sent someone to take off my head? When the messenger comes, see that you shut the door and hold it closed against him. Is not the sound of his master's feet behind him?" While he was still speaking with them, the king came down to him and said, "This trouble is from the Lord. Why should I hope in the Lord any longer?" But Elisha said, "Hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, tomorrow, about this time, a measure of choice meal shall be sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel, at the gate of Samaria. Then the captain, on whose hand the king leaned, said to the man of God, "Even if the Lord were to make the windows in the sky, could such a thing happen?" But he said, "You shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat from it." Now there were four leprous men outside the city gate who said to one another, "Why should we sit here until we die? If we say, 'Let us enter the city,' the famine is in the city, and we shall die there. But if we sit here, we shall also die. Therefore, let us desert to the Aramean camp. If they spare our lives, we shall live, and if they kill us, we shall but die." So they arose at twilight to go to the Aramean camp. But when they came to the edge of the Aramean camp, there was no one there at all. For the Lord had caused the Aramean army to hear the sound of chariots and of horses, the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, "The king of Israel has hired the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Egypt to fight against us." So they fled away in the twilight and abandoned their tents, their horses, and their donkeys, leaving the camp just as it was, and fled for their lives. When these leprous men had come to the edge of the camp, they went into a tent, ate and drank, carried off silver, gold, and clothing, and went and hid them. Then they came back, entered another tent, carried off things from it, and went and hid them. Then they said to one another, "What we are doing is wrong. This is a day of good news. If we are silent and wait until the morning light, we will be found guilty. Therefore, let us go and tell the king's household." So they came and called to the gatekeepers of the city and told them, "We went to the Aramean camp, but there was no one to be seen or heard there, nothing but the horses tied and the donkeys tied and the tents as they were." Then the gatekeepers called out and proclaimed it to the king's household. The king got up in the night and said to his servants, "I will tell you what the Arameans have prepared against us. They know that we are starving, so they have left the camp to hide themselves in the open country, thinking, 'When they come out of the city, we shall take them alive and get into the city.'" One of his servants said, "Let some men take 5 of the remaining horses, since those left here will suffer the fate of the whole multitude of Israel that have perished already. Let's send out and find." So they took 2 mounted men, and the king sent them after the Aramean army, saying, "Go and find out." So they went after them as far as the Jordan. The whole way was littered with garments and equipment that the Arameans had thrown away in their haste. So the messengers returned and told the king. Then the people went out and plundered the camp of the Arameans. So a measure of choice meal was sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord. Now the king had appointed the captain, on whose hand he leaned, to have charge of the gate. The people trampled him to death in the gate, just as the man of God had said when the king came down to him. For when the man of God had said to the king, 2 measures of barley shall be sold for a shekel, and a measure of choice meal for a shekel, about this time tomorrow in the gate of Samaria," the captain had answered the man of God, "Even if the Lord were to make windows in the sky, could such a thing happen?" And he had answered, "You shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat from it." It did indeed happen to him. The people trampled him to death in the gate. The word of the Lord. Okay, well, so it starts out with a pretty pedestrian event. The community of prophets gathered around Elisha need bigger places to live, which indicates that his following was growing. And so they said, "Let's go to Jordan, and we'll each cut down a log, and we'll drag it back, and we'll build what we need." And he says, "Great, go ahead." And they said, "Well, come on with us, please." So he's there, and a guy's chopping away, and the axe head flies off the axe handle, and it lands in the River Jordan. And this was bad news, because it was borrowed. And iron was scarce and expensive, and usually it was devoted solely to military purposes because of that reason. And so this axe head was a great luxury, and the law required that he restore it, and that if he couldn't restore it, then he would have to compensate the owner by selling himself into slavery, kind of an indentured servitude that would have lasted for a period of time. And so Elisha very calmly says, "Well, where is it?" And then he grabs a stick and tosses it in the water, and the axe head floats up to the surface. And this is sort of reminiscent of what he did in chapter 4, verses 1 through 7, where a woman's husband had died, and They had debts that they couldn't pay, and her children, her two children, were going to be made slaves, and he made provision for her. And what I love about these stories is, you know, Elisha is operating at a historical level. You know, he's advising the king helping him in his military exploits. But there's also time for individuals in distress. And that just gives you a sense of the scope of Elisha's power and his mission. And I think for people reading this in the context of exile, it would have been very affirming. Because at this point, they were not a coherent nation. They were a collection of individuals assembling the stories of their faith in what would become Hebrew Scripture so that they could retain a sense of religious identity and the idea that a great prophet like Elisha would take care to rescue individual people out of slavery had to be an immense comfort for folks as they were hearing and reading these stories. Now, the war between Aram and Israel seems to have been off since chapter 5 when Naaman, you know, came to Elisha and said, "Can you help me out with this leprosy?" But in verse 8 of chapter 6, we're back on. It doesn't tell us who the king is, but it's probably Ben-Hadad. And he is planning a surprise attack on Israel. But Elijah, you know, has this ability to foresee things, and he realizes what Ben-Hadad is trying to do. And so he tells the king of Israel, who's also not named, but presumably Jehoram, he says, "Yeah, he's going to attack here, so you want to beef up the defenses." And okay, now he's going to attack here, you got to beef up the defenses. And initially, Ben-Hadad thinks, "I got a snitch. Somebody's committing treason." And they said, "No, we're all faithful. It's this Elisha guy. He hears your pillow talk in your bedchamber. He knows exactly what you're going to do." And so he sends out some men and to grab him, and he's in Dothan. And this may not be coincidental, the fact that he's in Dothan, because there's only one other time this town is mentioned, and that's back in Genesis chapter 37, verse 17. And that's a small passage about Joseph. And, of course, Joseph was a seer. He could perceive things that others could not. So maybe there's an attempt in this little detail to present a linkage with Elisha and Joseph. And he sort of, it's a lot of overkill. He sends a large force after this prophet. And they see them, and one of his attendants is terrified. And Elisha assures them, "We outnumber them." But this guy can't see that. So Elisha prays that his eyes might be open, and this is sort of a theme of this section, is the seeing, not seeing. And he's given to see that there are horses and chariots of fire all around the mountainside. And, of course, this, you know, brings us back to Elisha's ascent in the whirlwind, accompanied by fiery chariots. And the Arameans come, and Elisha prays the opposite for them, "Strike them with blindness." Now, this could also be translated as dazzling brightness, because it's hard to see how, if they were blind, they could have possibly followed Elisha into Samaria. That would have been a very arduous trek. Okay, now step up here. Okay, we're going around the bend. A few steps to your left. Watch the tree. Oh, sorry. And the idea is that, you know how it is in the morning when the sun's just right and you're trying to drive and it's straight in your face. And it's really hard to see. And so the idea behind the translation of this is dazzling whiteness or brightness is that they couldn't see Elisha, and that's why they followed him. And he sort of, it's funny, he acts as their tour guide. And so Ben-Hadad's not even control over his own army anymore. Elisha is. And he says, "I'll take you to where you want to be." And he takes him straight to the capital of Samaria. And then he takes away the dazzling brightness or their blindness, however you want to interpret that. And they realize, whoops, we're in the very last place that we want to be. And the king is really excited. This is going to be an easy kill. He's almost jumping up and down like an 8-year-old. "Shall I kill them? Shall I kill them? Please, please, please." And Elisha says, "No, these are my prisoners. These are God's prisoners. They're not yours. You didn't earn this. Instead, you're going to show them hospitality. And that had to be rather galling for Jehoram, but and we're not really sure why. We're told in the second half of verse 23, and the Arameans no longer came raiding into the land of Israel. And so it would be sensible to infer that Elisha instructed the king to show hospitality in hopes that maybe relationships would improve between Israel and Aram. It's also possible, though, and the two aren't mutually exclusive, that this was a humiliation. Here they were, trapped in the capital city of an enemy, at the very best, they're going to be kept prisoner, but instead, they're treated with hospitality, and this would have been a deeply humiliating thing to endure. But this truce doesn't last for very long, because in the very next verse, Ben-Hadad gets his whole army together, and he lays siege to Samaria, and famine strikes. And they were willing to eat donkeys' heads and dove's dung. In the commentaries I've read, it's believed that this is a euphemism for seed pods, possibly carob bean pods. It was like a survival food. It was like the last thing you could eat when there was nothing left to eat. Kind of like haggis in Scotland. I'm not putting down the haggis, but it's a survival food. I mean, it's been promoted as a delicacy, but you know, it was a survival food. I'll ask your forgiveness later. And so it's just ridiculously expensive. It's so bad that people are resorting to cannibalism. And God was very clear in Deuteronomy that this is what would happen if they violated the covenant, if they didn't obey the law. In Deuteronomy 28, verses 52 through 57, and this citation's in your notes, "It shall besiege you in all your towns until your high and fortified walls in which you trusted come down throughout your land. It shall besiege you in all your towns throughout the land that the Lord your God has given you. In the desperate straits to which the enemy siege reduces you, you will eat the fruit of your womb, the flesh of your own sons and daughters whom the Lord your God has given you. Even the most refined and gentle of men among you will begrudge food to his own brother, to the wife whom he embraces, and to the last of his remaining children, giving to none of them any of the flesh of his children whom he is eating, because nothing else remains to him. In the desperate straits to which the enemy siege will reduce you in all your towns, she who is most refined and gentle among you, so gentle and refined that she does not venture to set the sole of her foot on the ground, will begrudge food to the husband whom she embraces, to her own son and to her own daughter, begrudging even the first birth that comes out from between her thighs, and the children that she bears, because she is eating them in secret for lack of anything else, in the desperate straits to which the enemy siege will reduce you in your towns, if you do not diligently observe all the words of this law that are written in this book, fearing this glorious and awesome name, the Lord your God." So these are the consequences of worshiping false idols, which hasn't gotten much better as the descendants of Ahab continue to reign in Israel. And so she comes to him and says, "So I made this deal with a neighbor, and we decided that we would each kill our sons on consecutive days and eat. So we killed mine and had him, and today she's supposed to kill hers, and she hid him." And in a way, reminds me of Solomon in 1 Kings, where, you know, one of the sons dies, and there's an argument over who is the true mother of the living one. And Solomon sorts this out. But this is a contrast to that, because the king here says, "I'm helpless. What do you want me to do? You know, we don't even have any food." And instead of, you know, actually addressing her problem, he tears his clothes, which is a sign of distress, a sign of penitence. And we see that he has sackcloth underneath, so at least he's moving in the right direction. He realizes this awful thing is being caused because God's angry. And, you know, he just sort of turns away from her and says, "God kill me if I don't have Elisha's head by the end of the day." Because he's blaming all of this on Elisha. And who knows? Maybe he feels like that Elisha's let him down. I mean, prior to this, when the Arameans were planning an attack, Elisha said, yeah, they're going to be here. Okay, no, wait, they're going to be over here in 2 days' time. So apparently, Elisha didn't provide those warnings. Maybe he did and the king didn't heed it. The text doesn't say, but it's a decent inference. I think more likely, though, is, you know, the king's like, you know, I could have killed them all when he led them into Samaria and he wouldn't let me. And so, you know, he got us into this mess because of his mercy. So he sends a guy out, maybe a messenger, maybe an executioner, maybe an assassin. It's hard to say. And Elisha, again, he sees him coming. And he says, bar the door. And here's the king's coming right behind him. And the king comes and he says, he stops blaming Elisha and he says, this is God's fault. And, you know, this lack of faith, you know, this trouble is from the Lord could be interpreted as, you know, okay, he recognizes that God's doing this because terrible things are happening. But then the second, why should I hope in the Lord any longer? You know, he realizes it's the power of God at work, which is causing all this misery. And maybe he thinks that the rift is unreconcilable. But he has lost his sense of God's mercy, which has been shown time and again. And Elisha reassures them. He says, don't worry, these inflated food prices are going to come down tomorrow. They'll be back to normal, and things are going to be much better. And, you know, just to look at some of the measures here, a quarter of a cob, which is these dove's dung or carob beans or whatever it was, a quarter of a cob was a quarter of a quart. So that's about 8 ounces dry weight. And that was selling for like 5 shekels. And so Elisha's saying, tomorrow you'll be able to get a measure of flour for a shekel. Now, a measure is 24 times a quarter of a cob. And so you're looking at choice flour, which is the best type. Barley is, you know, pretty rougher. You're going to get the best food at a fraction of the price that the worst food is costing you today. And the king's captain says, this is ridiculous. You know, even if God opened windows into heaven, and this might be an oblique reference to the manna, you know, there's no way that enough food could accumulate that the prices would go down this much. And Elisha said, you know, you're going to see this, but you're not going to have a single bite of it. We then quickly shift in chapter 7, verse 3, to these four leprous men. And again, remember, leprosy doesn't involve Hansen's disease. It could be veritably any skin condition. So they're stuck in betwixt. They've got an Aramean army besieging the city. They can't get inside the walls where there's some protection because they're lepers. And they're starving to death. And they're like, well, going into the city, even if we can manage that, it's not going to help us because everybody there is starving anyway. And so maybe we defect to the Arameans. And maybe, you know, we can make up some stories. We can act like, oh, we've got good information from you and they'll feed us. And if they don't and they just kill us because we're Israelites or because we're lepers, then we're going to die here anyway. So as night falls, they head out to the Aramean camp. And when they got there, there's nobody there. Because God had afflicted the Arameans with auditory hallucinations. They heard horses and chariots and troops, and they came to the conclusion, oh no, Israel has formed an alliance with the Hittites and the Egyptians, and we're going to take a really big butt whipping. We need to get out of here now. So they just left it all behind. This is reminiscent of when God deceived the Moabites back in chapter 3, verses 21 through 24. You remember that? The water came, and the water looked like blood to the Arameans, maybe because of the way the sun was shining on it. And so they said, oh great, the three kings are fighting against each other, and they stained the water red with blood, so let's go in and get our spoil. When in fact, they were facing three well-organized armies ready to fight, and they got clobbered. They fled. The lepers, grabbed some food. They grabbed some gold and silver and clothing. And suddenly they realized, partly out of guilt, but partly out of fear of punishment, you know, this is wrong. we need to let the city know that there's food here for them. So they go back and they tell the gatekeepers, and the gatekeepers tell the king. And the king's, you know, I think he's rightly suspicious, because this has happened before. You can look back at Joshua chapter 6 or Judges chapter 9, where you leave the camp empty, but you do that to set up an ambush. And so he decides to send out two men and five horses to check it out. So they go and they look around. It's like, no, they are gone, totally gone. So they sent the people out to plunder so they can eat. And that poor captain who doubted Elisha is put in charge of the gate. And in their desperate excitement, the people trample him to death. So he saw but did not eat of the food. And both of these fulfill completely the prophecy of the word of the Lord that Elisha spoke. It's ironic that four people who would not be allowed into the city wind up saving the city. The food prices go back to normal, and they all lived happily ever after until chapter 8. So, a lot of stuff happening in here. And we're revisiting some events, some themes that we've seen before.
The eating of your children, mm-hmm. that recycles in Jeremiah, right, where he talks about, yeah. That's a lot later, but mm-hmm. historically, but when the city is under so much, besieged so heavily.
Yeah, cannibalism is, you know, the sign of in extremis, and especially when you're eating children. And in a way, that kind of, you know, if you want to go back to the Moabites, where the king in his desperation sacrificed two of his children. Now, we don't think he ate them, but he sacrificed two of his children, and now the shoe's kind of on another foot. Now Samaria's being besieged. They're not doing the besieging. And it's just, it's unimaginable how it could be any worse. And you see this sprinkled throughout the latter prophets. You guys seeing anything else? Any questions?
I guess I was hoping by now that the Aramites might have figured that it was a bad thing to mess with.
You would think that the Arameans would have figured that out by now.
Getting a winning streak, something God does something to them, even though he's treating the Israelites badly. He's still protecting them, but he's not.
Yeah. I mean, it's remarkable the assistance that Elisha provides to the king. You know, Elijah was very confrontational with Ahab and Jezebel. And you might say, well, Jehoram was a lot better, you know, but he wasn't that much better. But Elisha is consistently providing him with assistance. You know, here's where they're coming, get your troops there. And don't worry about the food, the prices will go down. And he offers this prophecy even though the king had sent somebody ahead of him to kill him, or at least to say, you're under arrest, you have no right to remain silent, and it doesn't matter what you do because we're going to chop your head off. And despite that, he helps them. He doesn't allow the king to kill the Aramean force that had been sent to capture him, but he leads them into the capital city, and despite the fact that they'd come to seize him, he orders the king to show them mercy, and the king actually does what he says. So it's a significant distinction, I think, between Elijah and Elisha. And maybe it's because Jehoram is better enough that he's willing to accept Elisha's help, whereas with Jezebel on the scene, Ahab wasn't willing to listen to Elijah at all. Invading a country that's essentially under God's protection through Elisha is a very stupid idea.
I know this is a telling of the deeds of Elisha.
Mm-hmm.
But just to give an impression, Elijah's kind of everywhere. He's into everything.
Mm-hmm.
And in some respects, he's kind of a fly in the ointment.
Where Elijah is?
Elisha. This is just kind of the feeling I get from reading this. I mean, he's just kind of everywhere. He's got his fingers over here, he's doing this, he's doing that, you know. And the king sometimes listens and sometimes blames him.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't blame the king for sometimes blaming him.
Yeah, although it doesn't, I mean, you know, when you're a position of leadership, you have to take responsibility, especially when bad things are happening because God's PO'd and you've been committing idolatry and made God mad. You can't blame it on the guy who's being faithful to God. But, you know, we talked about when we made the transition from Elijah to Elisha in chapter 2, that unlike Elijah, who spent most of his time outside of Israelite territory with Gentiles as a way of symbolizing the fact that God's presence had been withdrawn from the people because of their wickedness, Elisha spends almost all of his time within the boundaries of Israel. And so the contrast between Elijah, who was always on the move, when he was spending time in Israel, it was mainly because he was going from one Gentile territory to another. You got Elisha, who's really more of a homebody. And again, maybe that's indicative simply of the fact that even though things are still bad, they are better than they were under Ahab and Jezebel. And you could even infer that they are somewhat better because of Elijah's work. But there are still shoes to drop. And of course, we see that as we get into chapter 8. Because remember when Elijah went to Mount Horeb, God said, "You're going to do these three things." But he was carried up to heaven in a whirlwind before he accomplished Numbers 2 and 3. But by laying the mantle on Elisha, recruiting him in that fashion, and then by Elisha receiving a double portion of Elijah's spirit by capturing the mantle as Elijah ascended into heaven, it sort of commissions Elisha to carry on the work, and he will be the one who raises up Jehu and who sets Hazael as king over the Arameans. So you see the fulfillment of this Elijah prophecy through Elisha. So nice Elijah is about to pass by the wayside, and things are going to get a lot nastier. I'm a caffeinated guy.
Caffeinated.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, Peter, go ahead.
The king, may God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if the head of Elisha remains on his shoulders. I mean, you think he would know that the man Elisha was a man of God, yet he's saying, I think it's very weird that he's praying to God that he can get the head of Elisha.
You know, here he reminds me of Saul. You know, I think that Jehoram's just coming a little bit unhinged. And that's what happens when you violate the covenant of God. You lose your moorings and you really start to drift. And then when bad things happen, you come to radical false conclusions and you act on them accordingly. And I think that's true for any person of faith. If you stay anchored to God, you're not going to be blown about by the storms of life. But like the kings of Israel, the farther you distance yourself from God, the more you float around to idolatry and practice injustice. When bad things happen, you're going to get us slapped around pretty bad, you're just going to do silly stuff. You know, so he should know by now that if anybody can provide them with protection, it's Elisha. And that may be why he's mad. Because, you know, it's gotten really bad. Where's Elisha? You know, he's helped out before. What's going on? But it's also he's trying to shift the blame onto Elisha. He's not willing to take responsibility. He's not even willing to take responsibility for this gross injustice. You know, he's just sort of mid-conversation, he turns away from the woman, and now his focus is on Elisha. It's like she's not even there. He's just going, you know, he's hopping around from one thing to another like somebody didn't take their ADD medicine that day.
That makes me think of today.
Yeah. Yeah. every once in a while, one of the kids will forget to take their ADD medicine, and it starts out as really amusing, but it gets annoying pretty fast. You know, it's kind of funny. It's just like bing, 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 bing. You know, and after about 3 hours of that, you're like, oh God. And then the next morning, you're like, did you take your medicine? Did you take your medicine? Did you? Yeah, good, 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 good. So.
That sounds like Jacob. Yeah. Hmm? He took too much medicine. The doctor overdosed.
Oh.
And he was seeing, we went out to a picnic, and he couldn't sit on the grass because Queenie Bee was there. I mean, he was seeing.
Oh, wow.
It was so sad.
Well, is there anything else in 6 and 7 you want to explore?
You said things would get worse. How could it get worse than cannibalism?
Well, things are going to get worse in terms of Elisha. Is going to end up fulfilling the instructions God gave Elijah on Mount Horeb. And this is going to lead to a much messier situation and a great deal more misery. And there's just a whole lot of ugly going on. And that's in chapter 8. So you just want to get going on that. It's a short chapter. So here we go. Now Elisha had said to the woman whose son he had restored to life, "Get up and go with your household and settle wherever you can, for the Lord has called for a famine, and it will come on the land for 7 years." So the woman got up and did according to the word of the man of God. She went with her household and settled in the land of the Philistines 7 years. At the end of the 7 years, when the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, she set out to appeal to the king for her house and her land. Now the king was talking with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, "Tell me all the great things that Elisha has done." While he was telling the king how Elisha had restored a dead person to life, the woman whose son he had restored to life appealed to the king for her house and her land. Gehazi said, "My lord king, here is the woman, and here is her son whom Elisha restored to life." When the king questioned the woman, she told him. So the king appointed an official for her, saying, "Restore all that was hers, together with all the revenue of the fields from the day that she left the land until now." Elisha went to Damascus while King Ben-Hadad of Aram was ill. When it was told him, "The man of God has come here," the king said to Hazael, "Take a present with you and go to meet the man of God. Inquire of the Lord through him whether I shall recover from this illness." So Hazael went to meet him, taking a present with him, all kinds of goods of Damascus, 40 camel loads. When he entered and stood before him, he said, "Your son, King Ben-Hadad of Aram, has sent me to you, saying, 'Shall I recover from this illness?'" Elisha said to him, "Go say to him, 'You shall certainly recover, but the Lord has shown me that he will certainly die.'" He fixed his gaze and stared at him until he was ashamed. Then the man of God wept. Hazael asked, "Why does my Lord weep?" He answered, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the people of Israel. You will set their fortresses on fire. You will kill their young men with the sword, dash in pieces their little ones, and rip up their pregnant women. Told you it was going to get ugly. Haziel said, "What is your servant who is a mere dog that he should do this great thing?" Elisha answered, "The Lord has shown me that you are to be king over Aram." Then he left Elisha and went to his master Ben-Hadad, who said to him, "What did Elisha say to you?" And he answered, "He told me that you would certainly recover." But the next day he took the bed cover and dipped it in water and spread it over the king's face until he died. And Haziel succeeded him. In the fifth year of King Joram, son of Ahab of Israel, Jehoram, son of King Jehoshaphat of Judah, began to reign. He was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. He walked in the way of the kings of Israel, as the house of Ahab had done, for the daughter of Ahab was his wife. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Yet the Lord would not destroy Judah for the sake of his servant David, since he had promised to give a lamp to him and to his descendants forever. In his days, Edom revolted against the rule of Judah and set up a king of their own. Then Joram crossed over to Zair with all his chariots. He set out by night and attacked the Edomites and their chariot commanders who had surrounded them, but his army fled home. So Edom has been in revolt against the rule of Judah to this day. Libna also revolted at the same time. Now the rest of the acts of Joram and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah? So Joram slept with his ancestors and was buried with them in the city of David. His son Ahaziah succeeded him. In the 12th year of King Joram, son of Ahab of Israel, Ahaziah, son of King Joram of Judah, began to reign. Ahaziah was 22 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 1 year in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Athaliah, a granddaughter of King Omri of Israel. He also walked in the way of the house of Ahab, doing what was evil in the sight of the Lord, as the house of Ahab had done, for he was son-in-law to the house of Ahab. He went with Joram, son of Ahab, to wage war against King Haziel of Aram at Ramoth-Gilead, where the Arameans wounded Joram. King Joram returned to be healed in Jezreel of the wounds that the Arameans had inflicted on him at Ramah when he fought against King Haziel of Aram. King Ahaziah, son of Jehoram of Judah, went down to see Joram, son of Ahab, in Jezreel because he was wounded. The word of the Lord. Okay. Elisha, this is a little bit of a flashback, we think. She says to this woman who's, you know, made the little attic room for him where he could rest on his journeys. And he told her, "You're going to have a son, despite the fact your husband's really too old to help you with that." She has the son, Allah, Sarah, and Abraham. But then the son gets a bad headache and dies, and then he raises him back to life. He says to her, "You got to clear out. There's going to be a 7-year famine. Go someplace else where there's going to be food, and then come back in 7 years." And she does. She goes to the Philistines, and after 7 years, she comes back. And this is sort of reminiscent of Egypt and Joseph, which maybe we have the mention of Dothan in the preceding chapters. And she comes back, her property's gone. She's abandoned it, so maybe some neighbors have taken it, or maybe abandoned property is remitted to the king after a period of time. And so she's wanting to get it back. And as she's getting ready to approach the king for this, he's talking with Elisha's servant Gehazi, asking for these stories, because apparently Elisha's back in good favor because his prophecy came true and people had things to eat. And right as Gehazi's getting to the part of how Elisha restored her son back to life, she appears. And Gehazi says, "Oh, this is the lady I was talking about, and look, here's her son." And so in the single instance where he behaves like a good king should, she says, "Here's the deal." And he says, "Okay, fine, we're just going to cut out all the red tape right here. You fix it." And so she gets her property back. Now, Elisha goes to Damascus. I just copied my Bible. This happened before. Ben-Hadad is ill, and he actually summons Elisha. And, of course, this is very different from what King Ahaziah did when he fell through the lattice in the upper chambers in Samaria. He didn't send for Elisha. He sent messengers to inquire of the pagan god Beelzebul. So this foreigner knows better than an Israelite does, you know, which prophet you ought to seek for an answer when you're sick and maybe dying. And he sends 40 camels load of presents. This is a lot of presents. And the servant he sends is Haziel. And he asks, you know, is the king going to get better? And he said, tell him you shall certainly recover, but he's not. And it's a little disturbing. There's a measure of deception involved here. But as we've seen many times previously, sometimes God does deceive in order for his purposes to be fulfilled. Because remember, Mount Horeb, you're going to set Haziel over the house of Aram. And so this is the fulfillment of one of the two things that Elijah just didn't get around to. I just sort of see Elisha staring at this guy, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, Bob's your uncle kind of thing. And he starts crying. And Haziel said, what's your problem? And he says, because I can foresee that you're just going to do awful things to us. You're going to burn our cities down, and you're going to hack up our young men with the sword, and you're going to, you know, tear open the bellies of pregnant women, and you're going to bash the brains of babies in. And I told you it was going to get ugly. And Haziel said, you got to be kidding. How could I possibly do that? And he says, you know, God's told me you're going to be king over Aram. I've got a pretty good track record on these things. So he goes, and Ben-Hadad says, well, what did Elisha say to you? And he said, just the first part. He says, oh, you're going to be fine. Everything's going to be fine. And actually, he's doing what Elisha told him to, because Elisha said, go say to him, you shall certainly recover. So he's doing it exactly as Elisha told him. But apparently he couldn't wait, because he takes some kind of cloth, he soaks it in water, and he smothers the king. You know, maybe he felt bad because the king was suffering so much. He just thought, well, okay, let's end this early. And yeah, exactly. Yeah. Welcome to Switzerland. I'm so bad. And then it starts to get a little bit confusing. King Jehoshaphat of Judah was, on balance, one of the better kings. And he succeeded by Jehoram. And he was 32. He reigned until he was 40. And he was much, much worse. Not the worst of the worst, but he was a lot worse than Jehoshaphat. And he followed sort of the path that Ahab did, because he was married to Ahab's daughter. And so very much in the same way that this foreigner, Jezreel, corrupted Ahab, their daughter, presumably this was his daughter by Jezebel. There's no way to tell, because kings kept harems at this point. He followed this pattern of idolatry, but God wasn't going to wipe him out, because again, the promise to David, you know, your descendants will continue to reign as long as there's a Judah. And Edom, which is to the sort of west-southwest, it was a vassal state of Judah. They set up a king. They rebel. Joram attacks. It doesn't work out too well. His army abandons him, and Edom remained in revolt perpetually. So you see this loss of influence, this loss of territory. Libna did the same thing. And then Joram dies. He's buried. He's succeeded by Ahaziah. So you have Joram in his 12th year. Ahaziah reigns. He's very young. He's 22, and he only lasts for 1 year. He's a child of Athaliah, who's a granddaughter of King Omri. So he's poisoned by the same well. Same stuff. They go out to fight King Haziel at Ramoth-Gilead. Joram's wounded, comes back, the mess continues. So
it's very confusing.
It is. It really is.
It's extremely confusing. I've been trying to separate them. All of a sudden, I did realize Israel and Judah, northern and southern, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And you've got the king of one, who is an offspring of some of the former kings of the other.
Yep.
And is married into the other's house.
Well, and see, Joram and Jehoram can be used interchangeably, and yeah, you know, it's like, you know, yeah, and you know, Jehoshaphat was really buddy buddy with Israel, you know, Israel get ready to go to war with somebody and say, hey, can I get a little help? Yeah, sure, let's do it, and. You know, in a way, that was perhaps a symbol of Jehoshaphat being better than most of the kings, because his support of Israel was, in a way, an attempt to bring the two kingdoms closer together, and effect some kind of reconciliation. And I think that's where you begin to see descendants of Ahab becoming, you know, kings over Judah. And which is just weird, I'm sure there's a good explanation for it, but I can't remember it and haven't had a chance to really study chapter 8 very well. It's, you know, this is just a foreshadowing of what's to come.
My Bible says that Haziel had already been anointed king in Aram. And it says here that his servant, in second...
Where are we?
Yeah, Haziel is...
In 1 Kings, chapter 19, verse 15, Elijah anoints him king.
Is it the same one?
Well, in 1915 of 1 Kings,
that's where we get the...
God tells him, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you shall arrive, you shall anoint Hazael as king over Aram. Also, you shall anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And you shall anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, as prophet in your place. And he does number three. He gets Elisha on board. But there's no indication that Elijah ever got around to Hazael or Jehu. And there's no anointing in Elisha's interaction with Hazael. But, I mean, this was a de facto, you're going to be king. And this may have actually inspired Hazael to kill the king. And because Elisha is carrying out the final pieces of the mission that Elijah was given by God on Mount Horeb, because you just don't see Elijah, if you sort of flip through, he just never makes it to Damascus. And then in the first part of chapter 9, then the prophet Elisha called a member of the company of prophets and said to him, gird up your loins, take this flask of oil in your hand, and go to Ramoth Gilead. When you arrive, look there for Jehu, son of Jehoshaphat, son of Nimshi. Go in and get him to leave his companions and take him to an inner chamber. Then take the flask of oil, pour it on his head, and say, thus says the Lord, I anoint you king over Israel. Mm-hmm. Then open the door and flee. Do not linger.
Hazael didn't know that he was going to be...
No, there's no indication given here that Elijah and Hazael met. I mean, and when you consider how surprised Hazael was that he was going to become king. I mean, he was totally clueless. You know, because Elisha starts crying and he says, oh, you're going to do all these awful things to Israel. And he says, well, how am I going to do that? I'm a nobody. And he's like, well, you're about to become a somebody in a big way.
There's two Ahaziahs, too.
Yes.
That's another.
Yeah, the,
and they're the same time, really. 843 and 855.
Yeah, you have... You know, Ahaziah in 2 Kings chapter 1 And he dies when Elijah is still alive and before Elisha takes over. So this is a different Ahaziah. And yeah, it just, you know, yeah, it, you just, yeah, the king sheet. Do you guys still have the king sheet? Yeah. Don't need to bring copies of that back. That is really useful, and I'm glad that I kept it for 22 years.
Well, I even caught, I mean, even just the little snapshots.
Yeah.
Oh, they're really good.
You just never know. And I'm also glad that I finally went through that big box of files and I was like, oh, this could be useful. We're in Samuel and Kings, you know? Because if we were still in Exodus, I'd have probably thrown it away.
So are we still in the line of David then?
Well, see, that's the question that I have, is if you've got, you know, what he has is... Jehoram is Jehoshaphat's son, but he's married the daughter of Ahab, so he's still on the line of David. And then when you have Ahaziah, he's the son of King Jehoram of Judah, so he's still in the line. But his mom is the granddaughter of King Omri. And
that's
Ahab and all his gang are part of the Omrite dynasty, which will fall in chapter 9 when Jehu is anointed king, which is the final mission that God gave Elijah, which he then passed on to Elisha.
You can plug in the kings of Israel and Judah into ancestry.com.
I don't know why you'd want to. I mean, it's not exactly something to brag about.
No, I think you'd have trouble keeping up with it.
So that means Joash must have gone back.
Yehu is the son of Jehoshaphat.
Yes.
Not,
well,
not the king, all right. This is a different one?
It's Jehoshaphat, son of Nimshi. I'm going to have to borrow this because I didn't study chapter 9 yet at all. And I just can't keep all this in my head. I know, it's shameful.
It's kind of like when I was in elementary school, about half of the male students were either Ronald or Donald. These names were
You know, I think maybe what we're looking at here is Jehoshaphat's the son of Asa in the southern kingdom. And so what you see here, yeah, I got it. This is the ending of the Omrite dynasty. Okay? So Ahab and all that gang, they get shut down because the guy, this isn't the same Jehoshaphat. I don't know, I guess it could be. No, it couldn't be. It's a different Jehoshaphat. Because this Jehoshaphat, who's Jehu's daddy, he's son of Nimshi. And the Jehoshaphat was the king of Judah, is the son of Asa. Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. Let me go back and take a good hard look at this. Well, you know, this is sort of a transitional period. But, you know, you look at chapter 10. Now, Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. And, you know, you're going to get a whole slaughter of people. His whole house is going to get wiped out, and it just, I'm not good at family trees because both of my parents are only children, and so I grew up really confused about aunts and uncles and cousins because I didn't have any.
And I have double first cousins.
And so it's, you know, I'll be honest, when it comes to things like genealogy, I get confused very, very easily. Not in this particular instance, no. No, there are not many branches on that tree. So.
It reminds me that we were in Paris and we were looking at Notre Dame, and they told us that during the French Revolution, there are a whole series of kings buildings up on the front of that the revolution people had cut off the heads of all and thinking that they were the kings of France. But unfortunately, they were wrong. They were the kings of Israel and Judas.
Oh, my goodness. So,
frankly, after reading this, I think they should have left it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
But they did restore them.
Well, that's
somebody
that's good.
Gathered the heads in another place,
maybe not all on the same.